Greetings, Rays community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Brian Sisco, like San Francisco, who serves as Vice Chancellor of University Advancement at NC State University. Welcome, Brian.
My pleasure, Brent. Good to see you.
And I said Sisco like San Francisco because that's what you said 5 minutes before we went live. So unforgettable now. Brian, thanks for making time. I know we've been working on scheduling this. Scott Morey insisted that we get you on the pod. We've had your colleague, Rashonda Mahone, on the podcast previously. And so long time coming. Appreciate you making time. And I want to know more about your own higher education journey. So take me back to, let's say, junior year of high school. Who was that, Brian? Where were you? What were you into? And what led you to Clarkson University?
Oh, my gosh, that takes me way back. It's amazing how time flies, right, when you're having fun. But, you know, I guess as I think about myself as a junior in high school, my primary focus was trying to win golf tournaments. I had an opportunity that junior year of high school to spend 6 weeks in Germany. I had been studying German for, at that point, 3 years. And I declined the opportunity because it was going to interfere with my golf tournament schedule. I'm yet to get to Germany, which is really annoys me on a regular basis, but it's on my bucket list, especially now that we have a nonstop flight from RDU direct into Frankfurt. So I have no excuse at all to make that trip possible. But my journey was one where...
And Brian, here's what we're going to do, all right? Like, we are going to scour every data source we have at our disposal and find you the absolute best NC State prospects in Germany just to make that an easier trip to justify. All right. So that is on us.
All right. Let's do that.
See what happens. Take advantage of that nonstop flight. I love it.
Yeah. You never know. Well, my story was that I ended up at Clarkson University as a referral from a professor I had at community college. So I'm one of those folks that was in a position where I didn't have the resources to consider something more than a community college opportunity. And yet it was a great experience for me. But I had a business professor who said, you need to check out Clarkson. They've got a decent business program. At the time, too, I was a soccer goalie as well as a golfer. And so it gave me an opportunity to consider continuing to play sports at a Division III level. So
love it. Hey, Brian, tell me, what was the community college called?
Jefferson Community College, based in Watertown, New York.
And when you think about that professor's influence, who is the professor? And it sounds like you really trusted that guidance.
Well, I wish I could remember his name, to be honest with you, but he had a friend who was on the faculty at Clarkson, and so I made a phone call and applied without visiting the campus, was accepted and started in the, I guess it would have been the fall of 85. So I was a transfer that came in as a junior and finished 2 years
there. Did you continue golf or other sports at that time in your life?
I had participated and played both soccer and golf at the community college. And then I continued on to play golf at Clarkson. I mean, for those that don't recognize, New York State is a big state. And Clarkson is located in Potsdam, which is literally 15 miles from the Canadian border. And so the nearest airports are Montreal or Ottawa. And so but what's really neat about that neck of the countryside is there are four colleges/universities in a 10-mile radius. So you have Clarkson, Potsdam State, St. Lawrence University, and Canton Tech, which is part of the SUNY system as well. Outside of that, the industry is farming, right? It's a very agricultural part of the state. You know, God's country in a sense. I think of Potsdam today. It was 20 degrees here in Raleigh this morning, which is very unusual. But that was not unusual. It's a very Potsdam-like day today in Raleigh. Sunny skies, but pretty cold.
Well, everybody should just Google Potsdam, New York, because you haven't before. And I will tell you, you'll be surprised to learn it's north of Burlington, Vermont, for example. You're way up there,
It's north of Lake Placid. Yeah,
north of Lake Placid. Okay, so just while we're on the topic of golf, you don't get to play golf at any level without putting a ton of time into it, and so I just got to ask you, like, through that a junior college, community college, Clarkson experience, just like most memorable golf experience and/or. And then I just got to ask, in your life, most memorable golf shot of your life?
Ooh. Well, I was one of those kids that picked up the game before it was cool. So at 11 and 12 years old, my buddies and I, we had a job at the local, you know, 9-hole municipal golf course. And the job was to hand rake the sand traps, with the understanding that once we were done hand raking all the sand traps, we could play as much golf as we wanted. And so, you know, in upstate New York, a lot of cold, drizzly days. So no one else was on the course except me and my buddies. And we would often play 54 holes a day, 72 holes a day. And what I learned is you either get good or you get broke, because if you're playing for a Coke and a hot dog and you're losing consistently, you're going to go broke. And so I determined I better get good, because I didn't have much money in my pocket. And so I went on to win the men's club championship when I was 14, and it's been, I guess, downhill ever since. But
you got that trophy somewhere? I want to see it in your, you know, shelf behind you.
That's a good question. I don't know if that is it. I don't know about that. I don't know where that one might exist. But I remember standing there in my Van Halen concert T-shirt at the awards ceremony. That's before golf attire was considered the norm, I guess. But
what was that? now I'm picturing a mullet. I'm picturing the whole deal at this point.
Oh, yeah.
What was that club called, Brian?
It was called Tomasi's. It's now called the Adams Golf Club or Adams Country Club. But at the time, the owner was named L. Thomas. And so Tomasi's was the name of the little, you know, I grew up in a one stoplight town, 1,200 people, where, you know, I would literally ride my bicycle the 1 mile from our home to the golf course every day. And that's where I spent my youth. It's one of the reasons why today I serve on the local chapter board of the First Tee, which is a national organization, but most cities have a First Tee chapter. And I think about the opportunity that golf can bring today's youth, who might be maybe a little misguided or don't have that opportunity. And that's exactly what First Tee does today. We serve over 1,600 young folks here in the greater Raleigh area. So it's rewarding to be part of it, something like that.
Well, I want to know more about that. I'm not familiar with First Tee, but I'm looking at it right now. First Tee is a youth development organization that enables kids to build the strength of character that empowers them through a lifetime of new challenges. By integrating the game of golf with a life skills curriculum, we create active learning. It almost sounds like I grew up in a no stoplight town in Iowa, and the 4-H club was a big part of my life. It almost sounds like 4-H for golf or something.
Well, I think it teaches, you know, 9 key values through the game of golf, but it's really a youth development program, as it says. So most of the participants are underrepresented or from, you know, inner city environments where, you know, just getting out onto a golf course is not something that's accessible for many of those folks. And so it opens up, I think, lots of opportunities just by, you know, having those experiences. So it's
I love it. I want to talk more about that, Brian, but tell me, you know, as you wrapped up the Clarkson experience, business focused institution, not a lot of jangle in the pocket, as they say. And so you're thinking about, you know, ways to make money and build, you know, your career. What were some of the paths that you considered directly out of Clarkson? And my understanding is you actually went on to do some continuing, maybe not continuing yet. You got the Bachelor of Science and Master's. So at some point you must have pursued that as well.
Yeah. So actually Clarkson's mostly known as a pretty strong engineering, strong private university that pumps out a lot of fantastic engineers. They're also known as one of the grandfather Division I hockey programs in the country, along with a handful of others. So, you know, we spent our days watching ice hockey with, you know, little Clarkson playing against the likes of, you know, BC, BU, Harvard, you know, Yale, Princeton, Brown down the line, right? And so a little bit of an irony in a sense, but really rewarding. So yeah, I was a finance major, you know, in the business program, who played golf. I wasn't an engineer who played hockey, but you know, my path was as a junior in college, I had an opportunity to have a summer job at a regional bank near where I grew up. And I was one of, I think, 15 young college folks that were asked to introduce the bank's customers to this thing called an ATM. It was the first time that ATMs had really, and this was again in the late 80s, that's when ATMs first became popular. And our job as interns was to convince customers to sign up for an ATM card. And what I learned, and part of it was, you know, we had, you know, kind of a weekly check on how many accounts have been opened. And I determined, as a slightly competitive sports-focused individual, that I was going to open the most number of accounts. And so while many of my colleagues, and we were assigned to different branches, many of my colleagues went in and sat at their little desk and waited for people to come to them. And I realized that you have to go to the customer. So I stood in the lobby and I talked with customers and tried to, you know, convince them to let me do a quick demonstration on this newfangled machine. And of course, you know, a number of folks were like, "Now, wait a minute. You're asking me to put my cash into an envelope and put it in this machine? How do I know it's going to get into my account, right?" And so, you know, spent a number of days and weeks convincing folks to do just that. And I was proud to say that at the end of the summer, you know, yours truly had opened the most number of accounts. But that led to a job offer to come back to the bank into a management training program upon graduation, which I ultimately did. And so I went through a year-long training program. And my story, I've told this so many times, it's like yesterday, but at the end of that 12-month program, I got called in by the president of the bank. He said, "Now, we've never done this before. Normally, we would put folks in as an assistant manager into one of our branches, and they'd learn the ropes, and eventually they would move up into the manager's job. But because we like what we see in you, we're going to put you in directly in as the manager." And I said, "Okay, where?" And he said, "Well, you're a Clarkson grad, and the manager in Potsdam is retiring, and so you're going up there." It wasn't Monday morning, but it was like 7 days from today, you're going to start as the manager in this branch. So make your arrangements and get up there and get started. And so 7 days later, I packed my stuff. I went back to town. Ironically, one of my college roommates called me in that 7 day period, said, "You're never going to believe this. I just took a job at a paper." He was an engineer at a paper mill in Potsdam. "So I'm moving back there." I said, "Well, you're not going to believe what just happened to me." And so we celebrated the fact that we were both going, you know, kind of back to our alma mater. But this time we actually have a couple of dimes in our pockets, right? So life is going to be grand. We're going to rent an apartment together. And my then girlfriend looked at me, now wife, but looked at me with, "Well, wait a minute here, time out. What's going on here?" And so, in that 7 day period, I realized as I was moving my friend from Cleveland, Ohio, back to Potsdam, I'm driving the U-Haul. I literally stopped at a shopping mall, went in and bought a ring. It finally dawned on me because I've got a U-Haul that won't go more than 50 miles an hour with no air conditioning and no music, that I needed to get my act together. So in that 7 day period, I bought a ring. I proposed to my wife. We ended up getting married a year later. But that was probably a critical aha moment for me, because I think if I'd moved up there without having taken those steps, who knows where the future would have led. And so we've been happily married now for 35 years, and you know, it's been great. But so anyway, I start this job at the bank. I'm literally.
Brian, I mean, hey,
I
you
know,
might
man. I
have told that
know.
story
It's
a whole
hard to
bunch of
believe.
times. You told it to me one time. Thank you. It's one of my all-time favorite stories. I mean, I've done 100, almost 200 of these episodes. That is amazing. So congratulations, 35 years later. And yeah, tell me about getting settled in as that regional manager. By the way, like, we talk a lot about mentorship on this podcast, right? And like those little nudges, conversations, inflection points that change the trajectory of your life. It's like, you know, the movie Back to the Future, you go back and the manager doesn't, you know, the president doesn't make you the manager, like the whole, you know, space-time continuum changes, right? So here we are. Amazing. I love it. And you got to sort of seize the moment. So what was it like settling in? And by the way, what's it like being a 22-year-old, you know, management trainee boss of all the people in Potsdam that I'm guessing were, you know, in most cases, well-tenured employees?
Right. So I move in. My office is, the bank itself is literally 200 yards from my fraternity. Keep in mind, I just graduated the year before. So I, you know, these guys are knocking on my window at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. Come on, you gotta meet us downtown. And I'm like, gentlemen, this is a suit and this is a job. I'm sorry, I can't do that. And it was tricky, right? Because now I've got responsibility. I walk into the branch on the first day and I've got 12 employees, all women, most of whom are old enough to be my grandmother. And I'm like, holy cow, what am I into here, right? I go to lunch with a couple of board members and I come back and one of the tellers is in my office and she's, you know, the tears are streaming down her face. And I'm like, oh my God, what happened? Did somebody rob the bank while I was gone? And she looked at me and she pointed at one of her colleagues and said, no, she didn't say hi to me this morning. And I was like, oh my Lord, what am I going to do with that, right? And so I immediately went to the head teller, Lois, and I said, Lois, how long have you worked here? And she said, well, 45 years. And I said, in all that time, you've never been, you know, empowered to manage the teller line? She goes, no, Joe always was in charge of everyone and everything. And I said, well, from this day forward, Lois, you are now in charge of the entire teller line. And she couldn't have been more happy, right? She'd always wanted that opportunity and that responsibility. And I said, and so that includes all the highs and all the lows. But and she goes, I got it. I just have always wanted that responsibility and Joe would never give it to me. Joe had been the manager for like 30 years, right? And he finally retired and they sent some 22-year-old kid in there to run the joint. And so I learned a lot in a very short period of time about people. The bank had spent time teaching me how to make loans and manage deposits. But, you know, they don't teach you anything about the human interaction, right? The human space. And so I learned a lot about managing. And I would say much of my approach to managing an organization today stems from managing a small team of people there, which was give people the opportunity and the empowerment, right? The responsibility and the authority to do what they know how to do. And if they don't know how to do it, then it's management's job to train them up. But at the end of the day, most people deliver, right? Most people deliver if given the opportunity. So I'm in this role. Go ahead.
Tell me a little bit back to your, first of all, you know, one of our favorite icebreakers is just tell me about your first job. You've told me about a couple, A, raking the sand traps, B, slinging ATM cards, you know, that newfangled technology. And so, but what struck me when you described the ATM experience, by the way, it reminds me a lot of my job, right? We're constantly looking for, you know, new ways to harness technology in pursuit of advancement objectives, but that means change, and change is always going to be scary. But what you absolutely have to do is get out there. Right. We got to get out behind the desk. It's part of the reason I love having conversations like this one, because I learn. It's sort of a virtual version of getting out of the desk in today's world. But when you think about what made you successful as an intern, not waiting, getting out there, you know, high activity, high relationship, qualification, disqualification, getting somebody to close or knowing where they stand that they're not ready right now, but going from, you know, prospect to qualification to yes, no, you know, quickly, right? And obviously an ATM card is far more transactional of a decision than philanthropy, but a lot of the principles still apply. And when you think about, you know, I'm guessing given the environment you described, Joe's there for 30 years, Lois is there for 45, you've got a big 10-year staff. Hard to imagine that you walked into now let's get out there and really be prospecting and having those conversations. And people might not have used words like that, but were you able to kind of build that sort of culture, because, you know, my sense is that's what makes a great development organization or any kind of customer oriented organization.
Well, I think it's, you know, I always, people are sick of me saying, you know, around here, which is, you know, reinforce the behaviors that you seek, right? And so it's very, in my mind, development work is very simple. You've got to get out and see the right people. You've got to ask them for a commitment, and you've got to close the deal, right? And those are the metrics that matter more than anything else. And what happens is the average frontline fundraiser gets distracted with all the other stuff, right? At the end of the day, if you're out there and you're seeing people and you're seeing the right people, comes back to, you know, sometimes the paralysis through analysis, right? Is, you know, the development officer who constantly cranks through the data, but never picks up the phone, never makes sends that email, never takes the step to establish that relationship. And I think that's true of all sales, right? Whether it's, you know, frontline fundraising or anything else. And so back to my quick story is, so I realized that, you know, the previous manager, Joe, he'd been the guy that sat behind the desk 24/7. He never got out there. And so I saw this opportunity in the community of, you know, people who had needs. And so I spent most of my time out knocking on doors. And the president had, you know, had challenged me. He said, you know, we don't do any business with your alma mater. You're a Clarkson grad. Get up there and get some business out of Clarkson. So I started, you know, knocking on doors and started creating relationships and actually started to get some of their business, you know, a certificate of deposit here, a little small thing there, but it was a start, right? But in that process, I got to know a lot of the senior leadership. And so I'm sitting there one day and I get a call. Hey, we have this job here in what's called development, and we think you'd be good at it. Would you be willing to sit down for lunch? And so I said, sure. Free lunch, you kidding me? So we sat down and they described this job of corporate and foundation relations. And I said, well, what's that? Well, you go out and you solicit companies and private foundations for, you know, for gifts. I'm like, huh, okay. I think I could probably do that. And they said, well, here's the kicker. You know, we'll pay you $41,000. And at that point, as a local bank manager, I was making 26 grand. My wife is a local teacher, and I will say this, New York has always paid their teachers better than most states, was making more than me as a teacher. But I thought, wow, that's a 70% increase. I can do that math. Where do I sign? and so I literally moved 200 yards the other side of my fraternity into one of Clarkson's office buildings and started my career in corporate foundation relations. And of course, what's the first file that hits my desk? KeyBank, which was the bank I was working for. You know, we've never gotten any kind of a gift out of KeyBank. So use your connections. And I will say, after it took a while, but at the end of a couple of years, at the time, and keep in mind, this is like 1990. So it's a few years ago, but KeyBank became Clarkson's largest corporate donor at the time, and Clarkson became KeyBank largest university customer at the time. So I felt like here's the merger of all things awesome. And so that got me an advanced career that's now spanned almost 35 years.
I love it. Tell me about the pitch at that time, because there is a spectrum of you're a part of the community. Clarkson's a pillar of this community,
right?
And we would like to seek philanthropy in pursuit of our sort of mutual shared interests in the community. There's that end of the spectrum. We'd like a gift. There's all kinds of creative work that has emerged in the CFR world as well, though, along the lines of, hey, we can create a talent pipeline for KeyBank where we can go from enrolled to maybe tailored curriculum, for example, or internship partnerships to really create a talent flow to KeyBank, for example. Like, was that sort of thing happening at that point, or was it more kind of bread and butter philanthropy?
I would say it was more about generating new customers for the bank, right? So it was preferred access to students where other banks weren't allowed access necessarily, right? So it was more a quid pro quo, I think, at the time than it was pure philanthropy. But it wasn't just about that local branch, right? This involved, at that point, that branch was one of maybe 50 branches around the state. And so this was a decision made out of kind of the regional headquarters, which was in Syracuse.
Yep.
So it wasn't just about that branch, but it was trying to set a model for what they could do in other communities with other universities. And so I think that was probably more of the drive. And again, we're not talking millions of dollars here, right? This is, it was six figures, but it wasn't, you know, the kind of, you know, gifts or grants that you see today on the spectrum.
So really good run in Potsdam. I mean, you must know everything about Potsdam. You should write a blog about Potsdam at this point. But so you know everything about Potsdam. As a point of reference today, Clarkson University has, let's call it 40,000-ish alumni in that range. And then you get the call to Syracuse. Big change, you know, let's call it 200,000-ish alumni. Same sort of general region, although a different part of upstate New York. What inspired you to make that move? And it had to be, I mean, seriously, you knew Potsdam better than anybody. And so, and Clarkson better than anybody. And so what was it like moving to a new city where you probably didn't know a lot of people and a place where you didn't know all the deans and the professors and the history and the mottos and all those things that I'm sure you had, you know, grown to know in your sort of in your sleep at Clarkson? What was that transition like?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. In fact, I found in my files the other day, I can't believe, you know, back in the 90s, right? This is pre computer. You literally wrote memos, right? I had a true secretary. We don't have those anymore, but Donna Seavey could type like 180 words a second. And so I would either hand scratch something out or I would dictate it onto a dictaphone or I would dictate it to her. She knew shorthand and she would literally type a memo. And if it needed changing, she could retype it in like 5 seconds. And so I remember there was a memo I wrote where, you know, I had an aspiration to, you know, someday lead a world-class, you know, top 25 university development program. And I realized after having been at Clarkson for 10 years that Clarkson just would never have the ability to achieve that, right? It just was too small. Its capacity was just so limited, right? And I had, you know, I don't know whether I like this phrase, but I felt like I had done what I could do there. You know, I kind of achieved what I could achieve, kind of optimized what I could do there. And I get a call from a guy I had met who had just started as a senior vice president at Syracuse. He had actually had been at Michigan Tech, which is even further north than Potsdam. He had tried to recruit me there, which is in the UP of Michigan. And I said, well, if I'm going anywhere, it's not going to be a place colder than this. So thanks, but no thanks. But he had landed as a senior VP at Syracuse and called me. And it was at a time in my life where, keep in mind, my wife and I, we grew up just an hour north of Syracuse. So closer to Syracuse than Potsdam for sure. And at that time, my parents were not in great health. And so here I am in my mid to late 30s, and being closer to home made more sense. And the opportunity to join a program that was larger in scale with, you know, with the potential to help try to grow that. And so my first day at Syracuse was September 11th, 2001, of all days to start a new job, right? And of course, anyone that was alive then knows where they were on that day. And I remember being in, I was meeting the director of Planned Giving when the planes struck, right? And the quick story there is that my boss and I were scheduled to meet a couple of trustees for lunch. And his son was at the World Financial Center next door. And of course, he couldn't get in touch with him. So he said, listen, you go out, meet the trustees for lunch. I gotta deal with my family. Of course, right? And so I meet these two trustees for lunch. And you may recall, I mean, it was a gorgeous day. It was a, you know, September, gorgeous, sunny day. And so after lunch, these two guys said, well, you know, there's not much we can do about what's going on in New York. So let's play golf. And, you know, I was at the mindset, you know, at that point, you just want to hug your kids, right? But what can I say? I'm the new kid on the block. So I spent the day September 11th playing golf, which is about the last thing I would have wanted to do. As an aside, I was four under par through nine holes because, of course, the best thing about golf is to not think about it, right? And so my head was elsewhere. But anyway, one of the things I talk about is opportunities that come your way that don't require you to leave. I mean, I've been at three universities in 35 years, right? And that's a little unusual, certainly today, by all means. But what I had were opportunities at Clarkson. So I ended up with three different jobs, progressively increasing responsibility over 10 years at Clarkson. I moved from an assistant vice president to an associate vice president to a vice president at Syracuse, ran an unbelievable billion-dollar campaign, one that we had no rights doing. I mean, the search firm, not search firm, the consulting firm said, looking at the data, you should probably focus on about a 500, maybe 550 campaign. A new chancellor came in and said, no, we're gonna do a billion because we need to be in the billion-dollar club. So no basis of data to support that. And of course, we launched the campaign in November of 2007, of all times to launch the public phase of campaign. Of course, Bear Stearns closed their doors six months later. And we had a mantra through the Great Recession, which was soberly optimistic persistence. SOP was the mantra. And we concluded the campaign in 2012 at 1,044 million. We made it by the skin of our teeth, but we made it on time and with the perspective of soberly optimistic persistence. So went through that period and a lot of transition through that time. And interestingly, it was right after that, so in the fall of 2013, the chancellor who'd been in place was asked to leave early in January of 14. Meanwhile, a new chancellor had been hired in September of 13, but the sitting president was bound and determined, or chancellor, to stay until the very last day. The provost was named the interim chancellor because they were trying to transition through a new appointment. So I had basically three chancellors all at the same time, all wanting appointments in New York City, all the same week. When I got a call from Whit Kiefer and said, we've known you for 25 years. You need to meet this guy, Randy Woodson, who's the chancellor at NC State. And I said, listen, I'm so busy, I can't even talk to you right now. I kind of hung up. And a week later, Manny Berger called me back and said, listen, I know you're busy, but would you get on a plane and fly down and meet this guy, Randy? I know you guys are going to hit it off. Worst case, you'll have a nice steak dinner. You'll stay at this place called the Umstead. It's kind of nice. And you'll come home the next day. And I said, all right, Manny, as a favor to you, I'll do that. And I came down and I sat with Randy
And
Woodson.
a track record of the free lunch, free dinner, gotta
Yeah,
go.
right. So I sat there with Randy Woodson for 3.5 hours and said, wow, this is at that point. And he is my eighth college president that I've worked with and for, and he's proven to be by far and away the best college president that I've ever had interaction with. And frankly, I think one of the best in the country. And so I made it was a tricky decision because I had a lot invested in Syracuse. By that point, my parents had passed away. But we still had, tremendous number of friends and family. And it's, like any job change, right? They're always tough, right? They're always tricky. But I saw an opportunity to, to really be the top dog. The interesting story about Syracuse, through all that transition with three presidents all at the same time, my boss had been suffering with a terrible bone cancer, multiple myeloma. And so he hadn't been able to step base in the office for over a year. So, but somebody's got to guide the boat, right? Somebody's got to run the show. And I was, in a sense, the number two person. So throw that wrench in. So, it was unclear with the new appointee whether he was going to retain me in that top spot or not. And Because all of this kind of crossed over at the same time. He was just getting started, and so I had a decision to make. Do I wait and see what's going to happen here with the new person, or do I take a bird in hand and make the shift to North Carolina? And ultimately decided to make that shift. And so I've now been at NC State for 10 years and living the dream.
Tell me about the first month, first 3 months, just big change, right? Again, really a new community, a new region, a new institution to learn about. And I always think about it's just got to be so overwhelming for any person to step into that senior vice president, vice chancellor type role where you have to learn the institution, you have to learn your staff. You have to learn all these other stakeholders. You have to learn the community kind of all at the same time. And so, how do you even, I mean, what advice would you give that Brian if you could go back in time 10 years around just how to manage such a big transition and all of the relationships that, you're kind of drinking from the relationship fire hose during a transition like that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, job number one is you got to get out, right? And so I think, on my very first day, the first thing I did was I went out and visited, right, wrong, or different, advancement at NC State's located in eight different buildings, right? So we're not University of Michigan where we're all in one high rise, right? We're spread out, and so that has its pros and cons, but mostly cons, because it's hard to create that culture, that collaboration when everyone's physically working in different parts of campus, and it's a big campus. And so, but I made a point of getting out and personally visiting every office, within the division. And I think, I think that's the visibility pieces is so much, right? 90% of it's just showing up. And I think a lot of it was just being visible. But I also learned very quickly that the advancement organization here had some real culture issues. And part of it was primarily due to the fact that it is such a high, as most land grants, a very highly decentralized, excuse me, organization. You got 10 colleges loosely held together by a football team, right? And so very independent in their thinking. In fact, we have 10 different independent foundations, right? And so managing the interface between the sense of independence and control versus group mentality and group collaboration. And in fact, before I'd even started the job, we were on a house hunting trip down here, and the staff had put together a reception for us to meet people, right? And so we showed up, and two of the chief development officers of our two largest colleges were essentially standing there arm in arm as my wife and I walked in. And I don't know if this is verbatim, but it's pretty darn close. It was, "Welcome, Mr. Vice Chancellor. There's one thing you need to know. As long as you keep the two of us happy, you'll have a nice long career here." And I thought, all right, okay, game on. Now, those two individuals are no longer here. And I think one of the things that, as I look back over 10 years, the thing that's maybe most proud from my perspective is this culture of collaboration and trust and coordination. It's never perfect, right? You'll never be perfect, but I think we've come such a long way in terms of how we all work together in this large enterprise. And I think it's evident in the success that we've had in our, we'll have our sixth day of giving coming up here in March, and just how the campus comes together. The fact that we did a $2 billion campaign for an organization like NC State, which, going back to you, so, what's kind of the first impression and what do you work on? I had an impression that NC State was a more mature advancement enterprise than what I actually found when I got here. And that's just driven by the fact that it's been so well supported by the state as a public university. Even today, a third of our budget is state appropriation, which is unheard of almost today, that such a high percentage of the operating budget is provided by the state. But if you go back 30 years, it was there was no need to raise money because the state paid for everything. And so NC State only started to get serious about advancement work, I would say, in the early 2000s. And so what I found was a place that had tremendous potential, but just hadn't really tackled some of the basics of what a mature advancement shop would require. So one of the things that we rolled out was a very tangible strategic plan, really focused on, imagine if we could tackle these big, hairy projects that don't seem doable, but if we could figure it out, would allow us to leapfrog in maturity. My predecessor, Nevin Kessler, had done a tremendous job to bring us out of infancy as a mature shop into toddlerhood. So I inherited a toddler, and I thought, well, if I could somehow find a way to leapfrog adolescence, right? Because no one likes puberty anyway. So if we could go from toddlerhood to maturity, imagine the success that could come with that. And so we undertook a number of these big, hairy projects, one of which you mentioned Rashonda earlier, which was to transition a very historical alumni, you know, dues-paying membership organization into one that's far more inclusive, far more expansive than, you know, focusing on 12,000 paying members, right, who write a $49 check. And Rashonda has led that team through that process. That was toward the tail end of our strategic plan, but we were able to tackle a number of these. And like I said, I don't know that you ever reach full maturity, but I think we've made some tremendous headway toward that.
And so when you think about that in the context of, not to get too specific on technology, but you described your experience with a big shift around the ATM space, and then you had to live through another transition where we started emailing donors, and then you had to live through COVID and sort of everything that we learned there. And you did make a comment in the pre-podcast questionnaire. You said we need to be increasingly adaptive to digital first interaction without losing the personal relationship that drives transformative impact. I think that's beautifully said. What do you mean by that?
Well, I believe that the Willie Loman model of fundraising will continue to have elements, right? We still need to take our briefcase and hit the road and have personal interaction with people. But as I mentioned earlier, I think the frontline fundraiser needs to get out and see the right people. And seeing the right people is where the use of digital technology needs to guide, direct, enhance that interaction, right? And or preset that interaction, because, you know, we've got today about 300,000 alumni. We've got over 700,000 records on our database. You know, you just can't throw a dart at the board and assume that that's the right next person to go see, right? And while my reference here is really focused on the maybe a major gift element, it really starts at the ground level, right? In terms of the work that we do in annual giving, the work that we do in leadership annual giving, you know, all the way up through the various levels of the pyramid. And this is where, you know, I rely on people like Adam Compton and Jeff Bainham and others to understand the application of the technology. I'm at least smart enough to understand that if we invest in those technologies, that smart people like Jeff and Adam and others, Amanda and others, will know how to apply that technology to the challenge at hand. And I think we've been able to do that, and maybe at levels hopefully better than some others, which have given us a little bit of an edge in building our pipelines and really understanding who do we interact with and how. I'm honestly thrilled that we're finally at that point where we're going to move away from a calling center. It's actually been profitable for us. So on one hand, it's a little you know, both ways here. But I can see us investing those resources in other digital technologies that will have a higher return on investment for sure.
Yeah, look, I think that with each, you know, certainly without a doubt, the pandemic accelerated adoption of technology like the one that we're using by at least a decade, at least 5 years, let's call it 5 to 10 years. And you know, I wish I was with you right now in person. I wish we could go, you know, with 20 degrees. I don't know about playing a round of golf afterwards, but, you know, do something, you know, in real life. But this is a fun conversation. I'm learning a lot about you. It's a real conversation and not quite as good as in person, but boy, is it a lot more efficient than flying around. I think that's what we've just got to figure out. Hey, when do you shoot that shot, buy the plane ticket, get out there, do the Willie Loman style? When does it make sense to have this sort of dialogue, which is far more elevated than a cold call at night, you know, through a phone or con? And then certainly, how do we scale it deeper, you know, into the giving pyramid, recognizing, as you've said, the 99-1 rule of fundraising is sort of where things are trending. And so there's always going to be that tension between, you know, how do we both do broad-based engagement well, but not really miss out on the potential to unlock transformational philanthropy.
Right, right. It's an interesting balance. I mean, I think higher ed continues to lag other sectors, right, from a standpoint of marketing automation and personalization, customization. But that's where we need to get, right? We need to understand that if you click on a video of puppies and kittens, that you might actually have an interest in our College of Veterinary Medicine, right? We need to make those links, right? And once we've engaged you, because I've long believed that if we can understand what your passions are and we can engage you around your passions, that we stand a much greater chance of closing not only a gift, but a larger gift, because we know what you care about, right? And it's such a tricky phenomenon for some faculty and others to get their head around, because they assume that if so-and-so graduated from my department or my college, that's where their passion lies. Well, it may be that that's on the list, but it may be further down. And maybe the passion is the library, or maybe it's the marching band, or maybe it's, you know, some other element of their student experience that stands out to them at a much higher level, that if we can engage them around those interests, imagine what the possibilities could be, right? And so understanding that, tapping into that, leveraging that becomes, I think, our challenge to be able to optimize the output.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, and such an opportunity to mine this growing digital data set to reveal those interests. Then you can layer on things like capacity and net worth and assigned, have they been visited before, and really start to narrow it down to an actionable group of people that warrant outreach right now. Because one thing that is for sure revealed in the data in this sector is there are way more qualified prospects than there are slots in gift officer portfolios with our current staffing model. And so the importance of harnessing that data to reveal the best prospects is critical.
No question. No question.
All right.
And that's where EverTrue comes in, right? I mean, that's
absolutely. I mean, look, like, I think that there are things that we've done. For example, you talk about, you know, just back to 300,000 alumni, 700,000 records. You know, there are, I'm just looking right now, just to get a quick look, there are 28 people who went to NC State that work at big companies that have gotten C-level promotions in the last quarter, for example. All right. So that's going from 300,000 down to 28. And then what we have to continue to do is, how do we go from those 28 like names with a real reason to reach out now, and based on their company, based on their role, based on their area of work, we might be able to connect that back to things that are happening on campus, programs, speaking opportunities, right? But it's like, if the 28 can be narrowed down, then what is the action plan? How do we kind of get out behind the desk in some form or fashion to bring those 28 people closer? If there are 28 people that have engaged with specific content from one professor in the veterinary school. What might we do to set up a small Zoom conversation between that professor, a handful of those potential donors, and a development officer, for example? So I think that like we have a lot of that foundation built, but continuing to make it just more and more of a assembly line systematic process without sacrificing, you know, the human to human connection is what we have to work towards.
Any of those in Germany?
Oh, don't you worry about that. We're going to follow that out. Let me check right now. You know what? Let me check right now. All right. So we got Germany here. I'm going to expand it. Oh yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm looking and you've got an alum named Christian who was just named president of a very large semiconductor manufacturer this month in Germany, specifically Stuttgart, where I was in 2006 for just a brief minute. Big job. So I am so excited for Christian that he now has an opportunity to move closer. And by the way, it says here that Christian is a scratch golfer. No, I'm just kidding. All right. So we're going to make that an action item. Lucky Christian.
Absolutely.
But in all seriousness, he just got a huge promotion. He is in Germany. It's a big company. That is a great time for NC State to be there because there's zero chance that, you know, he would have landed in that exact position without, you know, that educational experience as part of his journey. So
And never underestimate the value of an invitation, right? Just an acknowledgement of that promotion might be what triggers him to say, hey, maybe it's time to reconnect with my alma mater if he isn't already.
No doubt. I love it. And that is an area where, you know, Rashonda and team have done a really good job trying to convert that signal, you know, that move into a positive touch point. And I think that, you know, that can be the first step, but then how do we convert it into real conversations, real, you know, just like outside the ATM machine, you know, having somebody have that signal or interest is different than moving it to a real conversation. And so, you know, more to do. It's exciting to think about. I get fired up every time like that emerge. I want to be respectful of time, but I just have to ask you, all-time most memorable fundraising experiences, gift experiences. You mentioned Dave, Ed, Deb Fitz. I mean, give me a story or two of just standout experiences.
Well, you know, it's always the full circle ones that probably, you know, drive home the work that we do, right? And so we'll go back to our Clarkson days, right? So there was basically a discovery prospect that I worked with who was in the process of building a golf course, as it turns out. And I remember being on his gator and bouncing around the early makings of what is now a pretty nice golf course outside of Rochester, New York. But Dave was somebody that, you know, I had early interaction with, really forged a strong relationship. And in fact, I remember when I told him I was leaving to go to Syracuse, I wouldn't say he teared up, but it was almost like his friend was leaving him. Right. And while we kept in touch a little bit over time, turns out that my best buddy's on the faculty at Clarkson, remains on the faculty today at Clarkson. And he ended up connecting with Dave as a faculty member. And fast forward about 20 years, Dave ended up naming the business school at my alma mater with a $20 million gift, right? And so, and my best friend, Mark, is the Dave Ray professor. So he carries the name in a name professorship as part of the name college or a name school. And so to see something like that come full circle, Dave has since passed away, which is unfortunate, but his legacy lives on, right? And to think that, you know, I was part of, so I didn't close that gift. In fact, I'm not even sure I got a gift out of Dave by the time I had departed, because it was still a fairly new relationship. But to see that grow and to see him eventually leave his legacy and naming, the business school at my alma mater, which I attend. I mean, that's like storybook kind of stuff, right?
I love it. That's what it's all about, Brian. I can't think of a better story to close on. I'll let you give your team a shout out for sure. And I have to ask, are you hiring? And if people want to get in touch with you, I know you are active on LinkedIn, but any other preferred method?
Well, I'm probably the best LinkedIn stalker there is out there. So I am present out there. We're always looking for amazing talent. As a large organization, we now have 300 plus in advancement at NC State. We are actually in the final stages of a search for a new chief communications and marketing officer. I'm really excited about the finalist pool. It should come to a close here in the next couple of weeks. But at NC State, marketing communications is part of advancement, which is something that isn't typical these days, but I find that that interaction is critical for us to achieve our objectives, right? Because at the end of the day, how and what we communicate links so tightly to the work that we do in alumni engagement, in frontline fundraising, et cetera. I'd like to think that, we have built a culture here which goes against this notion that we're in competition with one another, but we work together to achieve our objectives. At the time we finished our $2 billion campaign, I did the math. We were the only the 12th public university to have achieved a campaign of that magnitude at that time. There have been some since, but to think back to that memo that I wrote in, early 90s, I feel like, well, we still have room to go. Being one of 12 public universities to achieve a $2 billion campaign, one that, was a toddler just a few short years ago, is something I'm very proud of. So if you're interested, come be part of our team. We've got a lot of exciting things going on.
I love it, Brian. Thank you so much. It's been a long time coming. What a fun conversation. Really appreciate you sharing the journey, and look forward to seeing you in real life here at some point in 2024 or beyond. Would encourage everybody, look up Brian, reach out, follow what's going on at NC State. And with that, I'm going to close today's episode with Brian Sisco, like San Francisco, who serves as Vice Chancellor of University Advancement at NC State University. Take care, everybody.